Hello, London. We are ready for your vote.
Hello, I'm Stephen Perkins, and this is Douzepoix, the Eurovision fan podcast from the team behind Bingewatch. I'm back again with one of my deep-ish dives into the history of the contest, but before we get into all of that, let's take a quick look at some of this week's big Eurovision headlines. First and foremost, 2024 co-host Pietra Mirda appeared on Instagram this week with a big announcement, confirming that she will indeed be doing one of her big musical numbers at this year's contest in Malmö, because, as she says, nobody dances or sings better than she does in Sweden. Hot on the heels of 2013's Swedish Smorgasbord, in which Carola was memorably blasted off the stage by an overpowered wind machine, and of course 2016's Måns Zelmerlöw duet Love, Love, Peace, Peace, Petra has revealed that this year she'll be performing a song called We Just Love Eurovision Too Much. She's hinted that she may not be the only performer involved, but the rest of the information is classified for now. Elsewhere, although Switzerland have now overtaken Croatia as the favourites to win this year's contest, Croatia haven't given up hope, and they're making plans to host in 2025 should the occasion arise. During an AMA session on Reddit, Zagreb's mayor Tomislav Tomasovic was asked about the city hosting Eurovision next year, and he responded that Zagreb is totally ready, the arena is already booked, adding, "We are keeping our fingers crossed for Baby Lasagna to win in Sweden, and we are ready for Zagreb to help HRT, that's the Croatian broadcaster, with production and organisation in every sense." Now, it can't possibly have escaped your notice that the 6th of April this year was the 50th anniversary of ABBA's win at the 1974 Eurovision Song Contest with Waterloo, so I couldn't resist the opportunity to go back and revisit the events of that year in what was a fairly chaotic year for the contest, if not necessarily on the night itself, then certainly in the run-up and the aftermath. And since the BBC recently made the entire thing available to watch on iPlayer, albeit with a small technical issue that we'll get to later, this was the perfect opportunity for a closer look. To start with, this was one of those years where the United Kingdom stepped in to host despite having not won the previous year. Our 1973 entry, Power to All Our Friends by Cliff Richard, had finished third with 123 points, narrowly behind the runner-up, Spain's Mocedades with Eres Tú on 125 points, and the overall winner, Luxembourg's Anne-Marie David with Tu Te Reconnaîtras with 129 points. However, Luxembourg had also won in 1972 and hosted in 1973, and broadcaster CLT was unwilling to host again due to the financial strain that staging the contest for a second year in a row would place on them. Spain also declined to host the contest, but the BBC was discouraged at first from offering to step in so that the process could be opened up to other potentially interested parties. Two other offers came in, from Israel's IBA and, rather dramatically, the BBC's UK rivals, ITV. The thing is, both of these offers came with fairly significant problems for the EBU. Israel had only joined the contest for the first time the previous year, so it was still a relatively unknown presence at Eurovision. It was also thought that some countries would be unwilling to accept the prospect of Israel hosting the contest at this time, and there were geographic and technological drawbacks to consider. Israel was a long way from a lot of the other participating nations, and the IBA's equipment wasn't really up to the standard of a lot of other EBU member broadcasters at the time. ITV's offer was problematic for a different reason. Only one broadcaster per member nation can take part at Eurovision, so allowing ITV to stage the competition would have meant excluding the BBC from being able to take part at all. When it became clear that neither the IBA nor ITV were viable options, the BBC did make an offer to the EBU and their offer was accepted. Both the Royal Opera House and the Royal Albert Hall were considered as potential venues, but neither were available in the required period, so the BBC looked at locations outside of London and ultimately selected the Brighton Dome for the 1974 contest, making Brighton the first English city outside the capital to host the competition. Katie Boyle was brought in as the presenter for a record-extending fourth time, a record that remains unbeaten to this day. 18 countries eventually confirmed their participation. Belgium, Finland, France, Germany, Ireland, Israel, Italy, Luxembourg, Monaco, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, the United Kingdom, Yugoslavia, and, making their debut at the contest, Greece. Turkey had expressed interest in participating but were too late in making their submission and would go on to make their debut in the 1975 contest. However, the French President Georges Pompidou died on 2nd of April 1975 and 6th of April, the day of the contest, was designated a national day of mourning in France, with schools closed and entertainment events cancelled. So it was deemed inappropriate for France's participation in the contest, which was to have been La Vie à 25 ans by Danny, to go ahead. The scoreboard for the contest had already been constructed, however, so an empty space was left at the end and the contest went ahead with 17 countries taking part. Ironically, it's reported that the reason Turkey couldn't join was because the scoreboard had already been built for 18 nations by the time they got their bid together, so seeing that empty space in the eventual broadcast must have felt a little bit frustrating for them. Meanwhile, over in Italy, there was a lot of controversy over their entry to the contest. Sì by Giglioli Cinquetti, who'd won the contest in 1964 with Non ho l'età at the age of 16, the youngest winner of the contest until Belgium's Sandra Kim in 1986. There was nothing especially controversial about the song itself, a beautiful, delicate song about first love or the first time having sex with someone, depending on your personal interpretation of the lyrics, but it was more the timing. Sì is Italian for yes, and the word is sung 16 times in the song. And 1 month later, on the 12th of May, Italy was scheduled to have a referendum on whether to repeal the 1970 law that allowed its citizens to get divorced. Italian broadcaster RAI were worried that the song's repetition of the word yes might influence voters, so the song was censored on Italian state television and radio stations for a month, which rather stymied Giglioli's chances of chart success in her home country. However, the English language version, retitled Go Before You Break My Heart, ended up being a top 10 hit in the UK. And in case you're wondering, 59.26% of Italian voters voted to keep their divorce laws. Hooray for democracy. And speaking of political incidents, things get even stranger when you factor in Portugal's entry that year, Paulo de Carvalho with Ai Depois do Adios, or And After the Farewell in English. Now, you could watch his performance and not notice anything out of the ordinary. It's a perfectly enjoyable, slightly schlagery ballad, but it was what happened to the song later that month that was remarkable. It was one of two songs used as a signal to begin the Carnation Revolution, which overthrew Portugal's authoritarian Estado Novo regime in April 1974. So much for Eurovision not being political. All controversies aside, let's get back to the competition itself. If you remember our episodes from last year about the history of the rules of the contest, you'll probably remember that the voting system was constantly in flux from the early 60s through to the mid-70s, but what you might not know is that there was originally a plan to debut a completely new scoring system at this year's contest. For the previous three contests, each country had had a two-member jury, one over 25 and one under 25, who gave each song, other than their own country's entry, a score between 1 and 5, meaning every country would get between 2 and 10 points from each round of voting. This had led to the results being rather close at times, so a new system was proposed for 1974, where the juries would be expanded to 10 people voting under the same system, meaning that each song could score a minimum of 10 points and a maximum of 50 in each round of voting, with a potential overall maximum score of 850 points. However, in rehearsals, this proved to be too complicated. It took far too long to carry out the voting, and there was a genuine fear that mistakes would be made in the tallying up of the scores on the nights with such large numbers involved, especially as the idea of using a computerised system to keep score was vetoed for financial reasons. So, as the jury members had already been recruited by this point, executive producer Bill Cotton made the call to ditch this new system and revert to the one used in 1970, where a 10-person jury each got to allocate 1 point to their favourite song, meaning that each country had 10 points overall to allocate as they saw fit. So, after all of that, what of the contest itself? Well, I'm going to start by recommending you watch it for yourself if you haven't done so already. For UK listeners, it's still up on iPlayer and will be there for over a year, and we've posted the link in the episode description to help you find it. I was actually pleasantly surprised by the quality of the entries when I watched. I could confidently say that I liked all of them on some level. There were maybe two that I was less keen on. The United Kingdom's Long Live Love by Olivia Newton-John, which I found slightly monotonous but still a respectable effort, and Portugal's aforementioned Revolutionary Call, which just wasn't really to my taste, even if I can appreciate it was well-crafted and well-performed. My standouts from the night overall were Corny Grupa from Yugoslavia with Generacija 42, which was suggested by UK commentator David Vine as being one of the banter entries of the year, given that they seemed to be keeping everyone guessing what language they were going to sing it in, but it actually ended up being one of the most genuinely enjoyable and interesting songs of the contest, I thought, along with obviously ABBA with Waterloo, Luxembourg's Irene Scheer with Bye Bye I Love You, and also Giglioli for Italy with C. As a modern Eurovision fan, it's quite interesting listening to David Vine's commentary, by the way. Of course, he's most known as a sports presenter, and he commentated on Eurovision much as you would on a sporting event, sincerely, with genuine interest, providing some useful facts where required, and not overtly allowing his own opinions to colour it. Although it was still the 1970s, so there were a few cringe references to how the men on the juries would definitely vote for the sexy Swedish blondes. Still, that aside, I found it to be a refreshing change to the slightly sneering tone of the UK commentary from the Wogan era onwards. And on the subject of the commentary, you might be slightly confused on the iPlayer version because around halfway through the voting, David Vine disappears and a Dutch commentator starts talking over Katie Boyle. Apparently this is because the BBC's archives didn't have the entire show, so they had to inquire the last 20 minutes, half an hour or so from elsewhere. The pace of the contest feels a lot quicker in 1974 too. There's no ad breaks, and Katie Boyle wasn't required to do any pieces to camera between the start of the show and the end of the performances, so the whole thing has a really good sense of momentum when everyone's doing their songs. The interval act was quintessentially 1970s Britain, in that we got videos of the Wombles wombling free around Brighton to the sound of the Wombling song and Remember You're a Womble, culminating with one of them ambushing Katie Boyle on stage with a sign compelling us to vote for the Wombles. Quite what the rest of Europe made of this, I'm not sure, but it did gift us an iconic soundbite from Katie Boyle.
Well, of course, I'll never forget I'm a Womble now.
It's interesting to watch the voting from a modern perspective too, given how differently structured it is. The order that the juries were called upon had been drawn at random, and given that there wasn't a standardised number of points to give out, the spokespeople read their scores out in performance order rather than ascending order of value. That does inevitably rob some of the tension for acts who performed early on, like Finland or the United Kingdom. If you weren't the first country mentioned, you could be pretty sure it meant you weren't getting any points in that round, although it did mean that the United Kingdom had the honour of sorts of being the first country to receive any points that year. Luckily for Katie Boyle, there were no major problems actually contacting the jury spokespeople, apart from a few slight connection delays and the Spanish spokesman clearly not being able to hear her very well. The scoreboard was updated manually by cycling up through the numbers from 0 to 9 in each column for each country. This did mean that if whoever was operating it accidentally overshot, they couldn't reverse course, they'd have to click all the way up to 9, go to 0 and then round again to correct it. Things mostly went well, apart from an issue with the allocation of Spain's points, where the scoreboard operator accidentally updated Ireland's score to 20 rather than 10. They don't spot this, but Katie does and tries to correct it, while the Spanish spokesperson obliviously carries on giving out the rest of the points, and she then struggles to hear.
I think we've got a mistake. Hold on a moment. We had a mistake with Ireland.
Yeah, that begins to lijken.
That's okay, isn't it, Clifford?
Also, the lack of a standardised scoring system means it's pretty much reliant on Katie and the respective spokesperson to ensure that the points given do indeed add up to 10. We even see Katie counting on her fingers at one point. It does make you appreciate what a tricky job hosting the contest was back in the day before computerised scoreboards. And even though there are a few faltering moments here and there, as a viewer I think you're really grateful for Katie's experience with the contest and her dedication to ensuring that the voting process is complete and accurate. In the run-up to the 50th anniversary, some of the UK jurors from 1974 have done a bit of press, and there's been some scorn attached to the fact that we didn't actually give Sweden any points that year. But, to be honest, I can't really, having watched the contest, bring myself to object to the points that we did give. 1 to Finland, 2 to Israel, 1 to Ireland, 1 to Switzerland, and 5 to Italy. Honestly, if you put me on the jury that year, I think I'd have voted for Italy as well. Besides, it's not as if ABBA's victory ever really looks in doubt. Although the margins are pretty narrow under this scoring system, it's generally a two-horse race throughout between Sweden and Italy, and Sweden are pretty much always a neck ahead. It's a bit of a shame for Giliola, who came close to being the first artist to win the contest twice, but let's not forget we got a couple of other landmarks in 1974. Not only was this Sweden's first victory, but it was also the first victory for a group rather than soloists or a duo. Indeed, David Vine mentions in the commentary while introducing Israel's Poogie that pop groups are still very much a rarity in Eurovision at this time. It was also the first winner that wasn't in an official language of the winning country, the language rules having been relaxed in the 1973 contest.
The winning song of the 1974 Eurovision Song Contest, La Chanson Gagnante, de Concours de la Eurovision Chanson La Chanson Eurovision 1974, c'est Waterloo, la Suède avec Waterloo, chanté par ABBA.
Here comes Charles Curran, the Director General.
That's it for this week. I hope you've enjoyed our little trip in the time machine back to 1974. I'll be back in a week's time with more Eurovision headlines. In the meantime, don't forget to follow us on our socials at bingewatch_pod or me personally at Stephen Perkins, and do hit subscribe on your podcast platform if you haven't done so already to ensure you don't miss any of our exciting upcoming episodes. And if you'd like to leave us a glowing review while you're there, we'd really appreciate it. Until next time, good night Europe and good morning Australia.